The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Pico Iyer is the author of 6 works of nonfiction and 2 novels, including The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama, which he will be talking about tonight. The author of this brilliant study of the great Buddhist leader is not a Buddhist. He's a consummate journalist. His job is to pay attention to his own inner monologue, the voices inside us asking many questions. But the Dalai Lama, he notes, would say that that is also the job of a Buddhist. Iyer had the distinct good fortune to meet the Dalai Lama when he was a small boy. His father, a philosophy professor, sought out the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala soon after he escaped Tibet. And not long after, he brought his only son there to meet the young Tibetan monk. Iyer's is a unique and privileged perspective. As a correspondent, Pico Iyer has traveled to war zones and covered revolutions from North Korea to Haiti to Beirut to Sri Lanka. Since he's been able to visit with the Dalai Lama for 30 years, he now returns that good fortune by sharing with us his observations on what the Dalai Lama, whom he reminds us is the single most experienced politician on the planet at this moment, has to offer our suffering world, which seems, as he writes, so torn up and attached to conflict. In conversation with Pico tonight is Tom Kerwin, an editor-at-large for the Los Angeles Times. Tom worked as the editor of the Times' late lamented outdoor section, did a beautiful job there, and from 1996 to 2002, he was the deputy editor of the Book Review. He has a beautifully honed literary sensibility, and he was the recipient of a 1991 Academy of American Poets Prize. His work as a feature writer has been honored by the American Association of Sunday and Features Editors, and this year he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for his astonishing column one piece about a bear attack. So if you want to know what to do if you see a bear, should a bear come into the room, you know, we can ask Tom. So now, without further ado, please welcome Tom Kerwin and Pico Iyer to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Thank you, Louise. Very nice of you. Aloud, 15 years. Can you believe it? Seems hard. I can think of no nicer way to avoid. Yeah, exactly. For Louise. No nicer way in the world to avoid the traffic than to come in here and have a chance to listen to the authors that she brings to this stage. It's really a gifted program, and I think we're all very lucky for that here in LA. So we're here tonight to talk about the Dalai Lama and Pico Iyer's wonderful book. I've known Pico for about 8 years now or so, and I worked with him when I was with the Book Review. And there are a few writers that I had a chance to work with that were so gifted and so thoughtful in the way they turned phrases. Pico would write reviews for us, and we'd talk over the phone, and some writers want to quibble over a word here or a word there, and you go, oh my gosh, another writer quibbling over a word here or a word there. But Pico, when he would bring up a case for an argument, was so thoughtful and so considered that you really got the sense that you're in the hands of a really wonderful craftsman with his prose and with his argument, and I think that's what makes The Open Road such a really wonderful book, for just the careful attentiveness that he's put into it, as well as just the superb reporting, and rather the difficult reporting, I think, that went into it. When I was thinking about how to start this conversation tonight, I thought to myself, we all know who the Dalai Lama is, but then again, I think none of us do know who the Dalai Lama is, which is really, I think, part of the point of this book. It's not quite a biography. I suppose that you'd describe this book as being something of a cultural history or a social history with the Dalai Lama at the center of it all. And I guess to open it up, to sort of put us all on the same page before we begin our conversation, would be to ask Pico to help us understand who the Dalai Lama is. I mean, we hear stories about rainbows and oracles and this little child. I wonder if you could just sort of remind us of and take us back to the opening here.
I suppose he's a much deeper, richer, more practical and more realistic person than any of us usually suspect. And I suppose one of the things I was trying to do, just as you were saying, is to really rescue his humanity, that I think most of us have a sense of the Dalai Lama we want or the Dalai Lama we need. And Beijing calls him a jackal in monk's robes and an evil spirit with the face of a beast, and other people call him a magician and a human and a superhuman and a sort of miracle worker. And I think what he does better than anyone I've met is when he comes into the room like this, makes any one of us instantly forget that he's such a learned philosopher, that he's comes from a faraway culture, that he's a lifelong monk, or that he's a head of state for 67 years, and just engages with us one-on-one as a human being. And he somehow has the gift of making all of that disappear and presenting himself in exactly the place where he meets one of us. And I think that's partly why we so easily underestimate him. And I remember, you know, in my own case, 20 years ago, when I'd go and hear him talk, I remember in the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium or something like that. I went to hear him and I came out and I thought, what a wonderful man. He has such kindness and such a twinkle in his eye and he's so attentive. And all of that is absolutely true. But I hadn't thought, well, at the same time, he's been dealing with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai for 40 years. He's one of the most accomplished philosophers in the world. He's as practical a politician as I've ever met. And Louise said in her introduction how I've been lucky enough as a journalist to travel the world for 26 years talking to other politicians. And I think I've been surprised in the course of that to realize that he is the one who is in some ways the most rigorous and thoughtful politician. Most politicians I meet always talk about the future and the promises they want to make or the past and all the grievances they promise to address. And he's the rare person who almost looks like through a microscope, as a scientist would, to see exactly what the situation is and what possibilities it discloses. So I suppose the first simple answer I would give to your question, having digressed for many, many minutes already, is that he's a remarkable thinker. And I think that's the first thing we forget. And so sometimes I try to remind myself that when he comes to town, it's like if Plato or Wittgenstein or the chair of the USC philosophy department came to town. And one responds enormously to the charisma and the warmth of such a person, but the real reason they're here is to pass on certain ideas that can make anyone's life a lot better. And so I suppose I was trying to deflect the spotlight away from the person, who's such a wondrous person, to the ideas and the people he's speaking for. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's good. And I guess what I find so interesting is that, you know, your answer shows how well you know him. And what I think is fun in the book is that Pico paints these really intimate pictures of the Dalai Lama that you wouldn't imagine. Because when I come to the Dalai Lama, I see all this sort of cultural baggage that surrounds him. As you write in the book, the Shangri-La effect.
Yes.
And how you strip that away from him to actually see him as a human being struggling with real problems, I think is quite an interesting story.
Which is, I think, what he's trying to do constantly, which is to strip our illusions or projections or delusions and to return us to a very real sense of who he is and therefore of who we are. The last time I was spending a lot of time with him, this was in Japan last November, and I was with him for a week traveling across Japan, and at one point we were in a bullet train traveling from Nagoya to Yokohama, and a journalist like you or me came onto the train and asked the kind of question a journalist would ask. He said, Your Holiness, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to resolve the situation in Israel and Palestine? And the Dalai Lama just looked at him, as I'm looking at you, with characteristic directness, and said, silly question. you didn't ask me that question, but I might have asked him that question myself. He said, silly question, really saying, if he had a magic wand, he'd bring peace to the entire world, he'd get himself back to Tibet, he'd find a cure for cancer, he'd get rid of the sore throat that was bothering him at that moment. And he was really saying, he said that, as he went on, I'm just a human being. And he said the Buddha and the great Buddhist philosophers were scientists, more than anything. And we expect scientists to be in possession of certain very specialized knowledge that they can share with us, but we don't expect them to be immortal, and we certainly don't expect them to carry magic wands. And I think over and over, what I hear him saying is he's a human being, prey to the same sorrows and concerns of any of us. He tells people he gets impatient when he arrives in a new town and his luggage doesn't arrive in his hotel room quickly enough. He tells people that often he's moved to tears when he hears stories from fellow Tibetans. And I remember, just as a small example of how he's in some ways powerless against the ideas we want to project onto him. Many, many years ago, 20 years ago, the first long piece I wrote about him was for Time magazine, at a time before the Nobel Prize, when I think very little was known or had been written about the Dalai Lama. And as a little kid who didn't know a thing really about the Tibetan situation, I described him in my article as a living Buddha and as a God king. And that the title, inevitably, for the article was Tibet's Living Buddha. And a few years later, I was talking to him about something completely unrelated, about the history of Buddhism and how Buddhism adapts to the 20th and 21st centuries. And suddenly, he got this mad gleam in his eye. And he said, you know, some foreigners call me a living Buddha. That's a complete mistranslation. That's a total distortion. And he went back into Tibetan, and he... The expert and profound scholar that he is, he extracted the words, he explained the philology of the words, he said that the Chinese in some ways had encouraged this mistranslation, and it was very unusual for him to say anything bad about China, but he felt so strongly about this, he said, this is a complete distortion. And so I listened to it, and I felt suitably reproved, and I wrote another long article for Time magazine, long article, taking in a series of discussions that I had with him. And when the piece came out a couple of weeks later, I opened it up, there was the head, a god in exile. We want him to be a god, regardless of his saying constantly, I'm a human being.
And why do you suppose that is? Are we so hungry in the West for... Do we blame Ronald Coleman and Lost Horizon?
Which was shot in Ojai, of course. We're closer to
exactly.
Shangri-La here than in Tibet. I think it is. I mean, we have plenty of political leaders, and we even have lots of wise spiritual teachers.
And spiritual teachers, yes.
Many of whom are the Dalai Lama's great friends, like Desmond Tutu. And so in our longing is to individualize by, in some ways, ghettoizing. And so the way that we can create an amenable image is to play up the exoticism of this person in golden robes who comes from a faraway country, where there are no paved roads, and all that is very true. But what's, to me, the excitement of the Dalai Lama is he was born in rural Tibet in a country that had seen fewer than 2,000 Westerners in its whole history, had no paved roads and had no wheeled vehicles. And now he's writing introductions to books on the internet, he's traveling on planes more often than anyone I know, and in some ways has very seamlessly made the transition from being in a very remote place to being in the thick of a global community and reminding us that these days we're all connected and nowhere is far away.
And to that, I'm interested in what you've written about him, because when you think about the Dalai Lama, I would suppose we didn't hear much about him in the 60s and the 70s. And I think he started sort of appearing on the horizon of our sort of consciousness in the 80s and certainly in the 90s and certainly now. You write in the book how he's resigned to the fact that he's not able to control the image that people have of him. But you also touch upon the fact that he's been able to use Hollywood or use the internet or use the culture that sees him to his own advantage as a way of helping sort of people helping shape his image for his own purposes. He's pretty shrewd that way. I mean, probably goes without saying.
Yes, I mean, he's empirical and practical, I would say. And he at every moment, whether he's talking to you or me or traveling to Washington and meeting the president, is trying to see what is constructive. I think his favorite adjectives are constructive, healthy, beneficial. I remember the first time he came to this country in 1979, I went to listen to him speak, and he was coming to Harvard, and he must have thought that Harvard was a very exalted academic institution, so he gave this extremely high-flown philosophical disquisition that nobody could follow, and everyone was excited to see the Dalai Lama for the first time in history in the US, but I think one person out of 1,000 would have been able to follow. And so he quickly registered that and realized, well, from now on, I should keep my metaphysics for fellow philosophers, and when I'm talking to general audiences, should talk at a level that they can appreciate, which is just what the Buddha did in terms of useful means, is the word the Buddha used, whereby he would speak as a monk to his monks, and he would speak as an everyday human being to a child, and he would speak as a philosopher to other philosophers. So I think the Dalai Lama has a very shrewd sense of knowing what will be the most constructive use of time. He says to himself, I have an hour in this auditorium, or I have 10 minutes with President Bush. What useful can I get out of this? And so I remember once I asked him, what's the most frustrating aspect of your life? And without hesitation, he said, talking to political leaders. Everywhere he goes, as the leader of the Tibetans, he has to talk to the head of state if he can. Uh-huh. And he has to, but he knows, and most head of states are very, very eager to talk to him and to bask in his glow and his charisma and gain by osmosis the sense of spiritual authority. But practically speaking, he knows very, very few of them really are ready to stand up to Tibet. So they're all eager to talk to him and be photographed with him, but none of them really has challenged China and said, please change your policy on Tibet. So in that sense, he was saying it's frustrating because he has to do that, and yet very little has come out of it. And at the same time, as a global traveler and as somebody who's always trying to see, who sees that anything can be used for the transmission of good. You know, I'm a Luddite, and I don't use the internet, and I think of all that as somehow corrupt. But the Dalai Lama has a much more spacious and much wiser view of things than me. And he says the internet, airplanes, whatever it is, none of those are intrinsically good or bad. They're only as good as the motivations we bring to them. And so, for example, Hollywood shouldn't be written off out of hand. Politics shouldn't be regarded as inherently corrupt. Any one of those things can be a vessel for good. And so he's no doubt noticed that people like Desmond Tutu or people like Richard Gere or some of the Nobel scientists he works with, they can actually speak across boundaries in a way that no political leader can. And in fact, can reach a global constituency in a way that no Democrat or Republican who's already dividing himself by that very designation can do. And so in that sense, you're right, has shrewdly noticed that the world stitched together more tightly than ever before. And the global figures that the whole world turns to, whether you're in Vietnam or El Salvador or Germany, are actually not necessarily President Bush or Prime Minister Brown, but they might be Bono or Vaclav Havel or anyone who is, you know, these days Angelina Jolie, who some of us think of her as a movie star, but most people in the world are probably grateful to her for working very hard on behalf of the people who most need it, the afflicted and oppressed around the world. And those of us who live and are sitting close to Hollywood tend to be very cynical about Hollywood and to forget that for people on the far side of the world, like me when I grew up in England and like me and my friends when I live in Japan, those people actually, we listen to them, and they have a platform that they can use for the good. And I once asked Richard Gere about this, and he said very touchingly and very humanly, he said, well, we're movie stars, we're sentient beings too, we're suffering and we're lonely and we're confused also, and why should we not reach out for the wisdom of the Dalai Lama the way a journalist or a carpenter or a homeless person does? We're in the same boat as you are. And you know, he's absolutely right. Whether you're a successful actor or a struggling actor, you're still dealing with all kinds of struggles, and you're grateful for a doctor's wise advice. Because I think, as you can tell from the way I'm talking, really I see the Dalai Lama, when he comes to the US and talks to non-Buddhist audiences, as a kind of doctor of the mind, coming here, asking people what is wrong with them or what they need, and trying to offer whatever he can from his tradition that might be of help.
I think that's what I enjoy about this book, is that you, I think a lot of times we make these sort of, we make these summary judgments about people, Richard Gere, the Dalai Lama, whomever. And yet this book is a reminder that once you get beyond that, or once you think about getting beyond that, then you're able to sort of understand a lot more about their sort of common humanity with us. And I think along those lines, I'd like to talk a little bit about your own sort of personal association with the Dalai Lama. I mean, I've known you for 8 years, but I had no idea that it goes back to, what, 1958 or so, when your father first met him?
Yes, my father met him his first few months in exile in 1960, when I was 3 years old in Oxford, England. And my father, as Louise was saying in her introduction, was a professor of philosophy and very interested in other religions, and I think was one of the relatively few people who knew even then that for the first time in history, this remarkable repository of centuries of wisdom was available to the outside world. So my father sailed all the way back to India from England, where we were living, and requested an audience with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama then is keen to open his door to anyone, because he realizes he can learn from anyone as well as perhaps offer something to anyone.
And he was new in exile at that point.
He was new in exile. He was 24 years old. My father was 29. And by good fortune, my father was deep in research on Mohandas Gandhi at that time. And of course, the Dalai Lama newly arrived in exile, was thinking with a special intensity about the Gandhian president and how to lead a non-violent resistance to an occupying power. So they had a lot to talk about. And actually, at the end of the conversation, my father, you know, like any proud dad, said, I have this three-year-old kid in Oxford.
Yeah, I love this.
And he took a great interest in the story of Your Holiness's flight to exile, because I'd followed every day of that flight as a two-year-old, crackling over our scratchy little wireless radio. Those were the days before television. But every evening, my father would turn on the radio to the BBC World Service, and at 7 p.m. we would hear about this young prince fleeing from his gold-roofed temple to try to get safety while soldiers were pursuing him and planes were circling overhead. So I was transfixed by that story. And when the Dalai Lama heard about this three-year-old boy who'd taken an interest in his story, with his wonderful gift for the perfect gesture, he found a picture of himself when he was 5 years old and sent it through my father to me. And of course, as a three-year-old, I didn't really know who or what this person was. But I could tell it was a little boy, and he was already on the lion throne in Lhasa. And I put the picture in a frame and had it on my desk. And I can still remember, every now and then, if I'd begin to feel sorry for myself, or I'd think, you know,
that's great.
If I sort of think, as some of us do, you know, well, life is quite difficult for a little boy alone in a foreign country, I'd only have to look at this picture of a five-year-old already ruling 6 million people, and things would fall into perspective. And then the one important coda to this is, you know, I kept it on my desk for 30 years. It followed us to Santa Barbara when we moved to Santa Barbara when I was 7 years old, stayed on my desk there, and then all of you in Southern California know how this happens. Suddenly a forest fire struck up half a mile from our house, wiped out our house, wiped out everything in it, all our possessions in the world, and in some ways brought home to me the most important Buddhist lesson, which is pictures, images are completely ephemeral. But the values and the ideas that they point to are enduring. In other words, it was senseless for me to hold on to that picture. It was one way or another certain to disappear from my life, or I was certain to disappear from its life. But nonetheless, there was a message in that picture, and there was something useful that I could bring into my heart and keep with me in a much more durable form than just that piece of paper. So even before I met him, I first met him when I was 17. My father took me to see him in Dharamsala. But even before then, I suppose this picture was already a big part of my life, and I was going through different understandings as I grew up and as the picture accompanied me and then disappeared from my life.
That's so funny, because as you were telling the story, I was going to ask you, where is that picture now without quite putting the connection to the fire?
It's inside here.
I'm so un-Buddhist.
Well, we all are, but and, you know, I'm not a Buddhist myself. But the great thing about life is it administers all these lessons, often in the form of shock or loss or sorrow, which inevitably start forcing you to think, what is important in my life, and what do I really cherish, and what can I hold on to? I mean, the day after the fire, I didn't own a single possession in the world except a toothbrush that I'd got from an all-night pharmacy, and that was it. So I had to think about, you know, where is my home, and what is anchoring me as I go through this life without any possessions. And I think there was plenty, but it was not a bad opportunity to be forced to think about that.
I think that's a major opportunity or a major catastrophe you'd have to come over in some manner, which is interesting. You know, I may not be a Buddhist, but I am a writer, and I also am aware that we are drawn to certain projects that sort of raise certain questions in our minds, and these are questions that we hope to answer that in the course of living with these projects, and a book is certainly a significant one. You and I have talked in the past about how you're sort of a mongrel of the world, as you've described it for me. And I think about the fire, and I think about the sort of the issues of exile that you've experienced, the issues of exile that the Dalai Lama's experienced. And I just wonder, you know, I'd like you to touch a little bit upon that, but also sort of think and perhaps suggest for us what were the questions that you hoped spending all the time with the Dalai Lama and reporting on this book would answer for you in your own personal life.
Yes, because you're right. I had lots of kind of public reasons for taking it on as the wars were breaking out at the beginning of this millennium and the world was more polarized than ever before. And I thought he would be a liberating figure. But you're right. I think in a personal way, because I'm a lifelong traveler and because I figure globalism is the reality of my life, which I have to turn into an opportunity, and because as a child of Indian parents born in England and then moving to California and now living in Japan, like more and more people, I'm to some extent a privileged exile. I was thinking about all those things. And I think part of the beauty of the Dalai Lama's example is, like Hamlet says, nothing is good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And I think one of the things I've learned from him is that whatever your situation or your circumstances, you can choose different ways to look at it. And you will be the beneficiary or the victim of those choices. I think the Buddhists often make a strong distinction between unhappiness and suffering. They say that suffering in the sense of loss and impermanence is part of the world, but unhappiness is a choice that we make. And looking at the same circumstances, we can respond to them constructively or destructively, and that's up to us. That's not inherent in the circumstances. So to speak less abstractly, when you take a word like exile, as you were just doing, I think most people, when they hear the word exile, they think it means severance or loss or disruption, a jarring away from your past. But the Dalai Lama, probably one of the world's most conspicuous exiles, says, no, it can be opportunity. It's liberation from the future. His first words I learned while researching this book, when he arrived in exile at the age of 24, having lost his homeland, his throne, and his people, he turned around to his younger brother and he said, now we are free. It's a remarkable thing to say. That instantly he was saying, now we can get rid of everything that was stifling and outdated in old Tibet. Now we can create new opportunities for women as they never had in old Tibet. Now we can bring democracy to Tibet, which it never had before. Mm-hmm. Now we can do all the things that we could never have done locked into our old position, that exile is freedom. And just thinking in those ways, somebody like me, who might think exile is a form of homelessness, realizes, well, it's a form of opportunity. And I think one of the great things he's done, which I never realized when I was staying in California, but as soon as I spent 3 of the last 5 springs basically living in Dharamsala across the street from him, talking to him and also talking to the ever more restless Tibetans who are chafing for action. And one thing I realized was that when those of us in this part of the world think of him, as you said, as an icon or a screensaver or somebody we see on Larry King Live, we see him at Beverly Hills fundraisers, and we forget that really 98% of his job takes place in Dharamsala among his people in Tibet and around him in exile. And I came to see that that was really one of his most impressive achievements. And I think what he's done is take these people who are strikingly unprepared for the world. When they all arrived in exile in 1959, no Tibetan had lived below 12,000 feet, none of them spoke English, few of them knew anything about the outside world. The number of lawyers in the Tibetan community was precisely 0. I mean, they're a very unworldly, remote community then. And he's taken that community and set up what even The Economist, which as you as a journalist know is not very generous with its praises, right, calls far and away the most successful refugee community in the world. They've got very deep roots in India now, but also in Switzerland, California, all over. And they're doing very well. So what I think the first thing he's done is take this dispossessed people and create a very strong home for them in India and elsewhere. But more deeply, and this really speaks to your question, he's reminded them, and therefore all of us, that home has nothing to do with the physical construction and everything to do with the values and loyalties and affiliations we carry around with us. And what he's told the Tibetans is, even if there's no place called Tibet on the map, so long as you have Tibet's culture and the best part of Tibet alive in your hearts and in your community, then the best part of Tibet is still with us in the world and, in fact, is scattered around the world more productively than ever before. And in a small way, I think he's addressing the Palestinians, the Uyghurs, the Kurds, people like me. I can see, looking around, quite a few people in this room who are in some ways exiles and have been thinking about how to create a sense of tradition or belonging or community. And he's reminding us that even if you lose the physical home, even if you lose piece of soil, so long as you have common grounds or common foundations, you've got everything that's essential about your tradition inside you, and that's something that's much harder to be stripped of. And I think, again, in the short term, he's looking at the Tibetans, but implicitly, he's addressing many other people. And so I was interested, I suppose, just to think, I've written a lot about globalism, and I wrote a book called The Global Soul 8 years ago about the conundrum of the modern world and everyone having to construct their sense of home and tradition from scratch, more and more people. And I deliberately called this book The Open Road, The Global Soul, The Open Road, same number of syllables, same sounds, even the chapter headings are identical from that book to this. And The Global Soul was a presentation of a conundrum, and this is a kind of answer to it. This is one person who is embodying, I think, a very useful and exciting response to the global predicament. And is saying, for example, if you really think of the world as a global neighborhood. Like in any neighborhood, you can't afford to throw a stone through your neighbor's window because you'll suffer, your neighbor will suffer, and the whole neighborhood will suffer. So we'll get into that later,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, but the interconnectedness that he talks about is really fascinating. Yeah. How very difficult to come to that perspective, though, that sense that the home is inside of you. I mean, I admire that, but wonder about whether, you know, when you were there in Dharamsala, did you see sort of, I mean, I'm sure you saw sort of palpable sort of tensions between people that weren't able to hold on to that sort of idealized notion of home quite as successfully as he.
Yes, no, that's beautifully said. And I think we've heard a lot about those people and from those people in recent weeks.
Right.
And I think the Dalai Lama understands their basic human plea and cry better than anyone. And they're just saying, how can we sit by and practice of nonviolence and forbearance and tolerance while our country is being wiped out and our cousins are being imprisoned and our mothers are being killed? And of course, he feels that as acutely as ever. But he knows that if they act against China, it will only bring more suffering to people who suffered much too much already. Tibetans are outnumbered by 200 to 1. The Dalai Lama has dealt with Beijing leadership now for 58 years, and he knows that there's a strong sense of pride there and a strong sense of face. And if challenged, it will respond with a violent response. It has to be handled very delicately. And he also knows that the fact of the matter is that the majority of the residents of the Tibetan capital of Lhasa now are Chinese. And so the Tibetan situation won't be resolved just when the needs of Tibetans are taken care of. You have to include the Chinese people who now represent a very significant part of that place that's called Tibet. So the easy answers and the romantic gestures, I think he's saying, won't work. And one interesting thing... but it's in the book, but at one point I asked him about what he thought would happen when he's no longer around. And the first thing he mentioned was not Tibet and not China, but it was India. And he reminded me, as I'd foolishly forgotten, that India has only graciously taken in the Tibetans on the grounds that they're a spiritual dispossessed community. And if the Tibetans in India were to start taking political action, it would put India in a very, very difficult situation, and India might be forced to boot them out, because suddenly India would be the home for a group not necessarily of terrorists, but certainly of people violently resisting China, and it would bring Delhi and Beijing into head-on confrontation. So again, the Dalai Lama, I think, was thinking one or two steps beyond those restless
Tibetans. That interconnectedness that you're
yes,
talking
that's
about.
Right, exactly. You can't take any one piece out of the web and resolve it, because right. All the other pieces are dependent on it. And again, it's one of those things I think about in my own life, too. And, you know, I think the beauty of so many of his ideas is they're applicable to anyone, if you want to so take them. If I were to go back to my home in Santa Barbara today and find that my neighbor had thrown a stone through my window, you know, I could go and do the same to him. But one way or another, that could set into motion repercussions that are going to enfold and poison and wound the whole neighborhood for months or years to come. The only way to break that cycle is for me to go to my neighbor and say, you've committed this act of violence, but let's talk about it. Can you tell me why you did it? Is there something I can do to make it better? Is there something you can do so that we break out of this interlocked struggle? And that's exactly what he's doing to the Chinese, or with the Chinese. And again, he's a realist. He told me 12 years ago that if you look at his actions from one point of view, which is to say forgiveness and nonviolence and peace, it's borne no fruit. He said to me, I've held to this policy for 40 years, and the only result so far is that China has come down harder and harder on the Tibetans. And of course, it's very hard for him to hold to a policy whose victims are his own people that he cares about so much. But he understood that that doesn't make it a wrong policy. It just makes it a far-sighted policy, and he's thinking in terms of future generations. And he knows, I think, most of all, that let's say Tibetans were to perpetrate some nonviolent terrorist acts, blow up a train or blow up a power station in China. The whole conscience of the world would be galvanized for 5 days, and we'd all care and think about Tibet. And then our election would come along, or something else would happen, another earthquake would come along, and instantly we'd forget about it.
Right.
And the only advantage that Tibet has over most of the freedom struggles in the world is that it's kept to the higher ground and that it hasn't practiced violence so far. And that's the reason why those people around the world who care about Tibet, because it's speaking to the best part of us. And if the Tibetans started practicing violence, even though most of us sympathize with their cause and understand their frustration, not all of us would necessarily think that violence is a good solution for their problems or for ours.
What's fascinating in all that you've said is that I'm thinking about these notes that I've taken to try to lead us through this conversation, and I was going to try to save the politics for a little bit later in the hour or so as we talk, but it's interesting how in just talking about the Dalai Lama, they've immediately rushed into the forefront.
Because I think everything is so interconnected.
Yeah, precisely.
And when I began the book, the first thing I thought of, which is what everyone in this room would think of, is that he's in an unusual position because he's a monk, he's a head of state, he's a head of a philosophy, he's an amateur scientist and a serious scientist, and he's a regular man. So he's got all these different roles. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized what was unusual and perhaps exciting about it was that he was pushing all these roles together. So he's the only head of state I know in the world who is a monk, and who works in the world of realpolitik from that much more spacious and selfless and far-sighted vision of a monk. And he's also the only monk I know who holds absolutely to scientific principles and who says that even the Buddha's words should be thrown out if scientific research at Caltech finds it to be incomplete or faulty. Mm-hmm. And so at every point, again, you can't see his roles independently. When you think about him as a monk, what's interesting is he's a monastic scientist. And when you see him as a politician, what's interesting is that he's a political monk or a monastic politician. And they're all threaded together. And as you know, when I wrote this book, part of the interesting challenge just as a writer was in writing about each of these nine lives of him, each life involves all the others. And so I had to kind of make a new kind of narrative in which there wasn't one section about being a monk and one section about being a globalist, but they were all intertwined because I think that's how his vision is.
And it's wonderfully interconnected the way you've woven it together here. Because I am personally interested in learning a little bit more about who he is, I have to ask these sort of vicarious questions. When you were interviewing him, did you run a tape recorder?
Yes. I mean, as you know, I've gone to see him for all these 30 years in two capacities. One as a friend or a son of a friend, uh-huh. a colleague, and one as a journalist. And so every time I go and see him, the people setting up the meeting, his private secretary says, is this an audience or is it an interview? If it's an interview, I take a tape recorder and he knows that I'm going to use his words in an article I write. Uh-huh. If it's an audience, he's that much more relaxed and will say things that, you know, largely off the record.
There's a wonderful part in the book where you sort of talk about his cadence, how he speaks, how when you ask him a question,
yes.
there's sort of a descending silence yes. as you sort of sense him sort of slowly, you know, you say it better than I do.
No, that's right. Sometimes I'll ask him a question and just be silent for a long, 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 long time. And it's almost as if he's clicking through the hard drive in his mind to find the most essential principle. And I think one of his great gifts, which is a gift that many monks have, I spend a lot of time in monasteries, so I've witnessed it among Catholic friends of mine who are monks, is seeing instantly to the core of something, to see to the essential. So he clicks through all the ideas, and then he comes out with the center of it, or the most fundamental principle. And he begins very, very slowly, and then it's almost like a car that's been in a residential neighborhood that's going out onto the freeway or onto the open road, and it accelerates. And, you know, as a keen philosopher who loves seeing things from every point of view, as he's unfolding his perspective, he realizes, well, look at it from over here, or look at it from the counter position, or turn it upside down, and what does that lead to? And then he starts framing it almost as a kind of philosophical discourse, and he clicks off fingers, and he says, well, this is the first point, A, B, C, and this is the second, D, E, F. And you can see this man who's been trained for 18 years in logic, but even more than that, the central practice in his form of Buddhism is debating. And it's about learning to see every situation from myriad perspectives. So when he thinks about the Tibetan situation, he sees it as Tibetans would, and then he sees it as the Chinese would, and then he sees it as Californians would. And he feels that there's something to be gained in any situation from seeing it and around and not being locked in your own situation. So I think that's part of what I see as he's beginning to talk.
And you have some nice encounters with his brother in
yes.
which that debating,
yes.
you sort of have to come to the forefront and think about debating and engaging with him in such a manner.
Yes.
And it's forceful debating, too.
Very forceful. And his younger brother is like the Dalai Lama who's always off the record. They've lived together for 40 years.
Bizarro Dalai Lama.
Yes. He's a high incarnate Lama who, in fact, stripped himself of his robes and is a disrobed monk. But he seems to be more a monk than most monks I know, but he doesn't wear the clothes. So yes, indeed, he would love the term bizarro. He shares with the Dalai Lama irreverence and a love of informality. So
right.
Next time I see him, I'll pass on that. He'll gladly cling to it. accurate, probably. Bizarro Dalai Lama non-PhD or some such. Their faces are very, very similar. They've lived together all their lives. He's the little brother who was 13 when they fled, was by his side as they left Lhasa and came into India on that 14-day journey. He studied on a daily basis for his entire 60 years with the Dalai Lama. So his modes of thinking are very, very similar. And whatever I say to him, he'll come with a challenge. And I found it's a very fruitful thing. I remember once he gave me a book about Buddhism, very technical, philosophical book. And I read the whole thing, and I went to see him again a week later. And I was sort of proud I'd read it, and I'd understood a bit of it. And I said to him, well, you know, I suppose all of us are just really tiny. We're just like a speck in the valley. He said, what? You're saying we're just ants? No. You're crazy. I don't want to be a vegetable. I don't want to be a Zen monk. And he gave this very powerful answer. And then, you know, I looked a little startled and I came back with that. And he challenged every position. And then discernibly, just like the Dalai Lama, his face completely changed. And he more or less said, well, remember, I'm giving you a hard time just to keep you honest and to free you from your assumptions. This isn't personal, but I'm just trying to remind you that whatever position you take is only a partial position and could be seen. So, I mean, it's a very compassionate kind of teaching. But it's startling at first. I remember a few years ago, actually 15 years ago, I went to see him, and I was very excited about Tibet then, and I'd just made my second trip to Tibet. And he said, you're just a groupie. You're just talking about Shangri-La. And he said, this is the Shangri-La syndrome. All you Westerners think everything is wonderful in Tibet, and all we Tibetans try to turn that to advantage. That's not the way things are. You know, we're all human beings. Please get out of your head this notion of that everything is perfect in Tibet. And very useful lesson. But
no, I enjoy the interactions because it comes across as sort of a foil to the Dalai Lama himself speaking with a brother, and he gets a nice acknowledgement in the book as well. He was very helpful in the writing of the book.
Yes, I know. I've learned so much from him.
Yeah. You open the first segment of this book with when the Dalai Lama, Vaclav Havel, and help me, who are the other two individuals?
Desmond Tutu and Shirin Ebadi.
Exactly.
Go to
Vancouver to get honorary degrees. And it's just such an interesting sort of sequence that you write about there. And you talk about how you'd hope to see if globalism could acquire an inwardness beyond data and goods. Mm. It's funny because as I read that, it's a wonderful line and it's a wonderful notion, because I think we're all sort of inundated with the materialism of globalism and the sort of, even the sort of information glut of globalism. But I wonder, how did you, I don't know if I came to an answer at the end of this book as to whether you were able to find whether globalism was able to acquire an inwardness beyond data and goods.
Well, that's a very profound question. And I think there's a globalism of goods and there's a globalism of values. And one reason that I wrote that book a few years ago called The Global Soul was to try to insert a soul in globalism, just because, as you said so wonderfully just now, usually when we think of globalism, it's in terms of the marketplace or technology. And a globalism that is only McDonald's, Microsoft, and MTV is not really going to sustain us or the rest of the world. That if we really are knit together in a global community, we have to think about what a global conscience and global responsibility and global imagination are, as some of our great writers do. And so certainly a question that I've been playing with for a long, long time. And I felt that given that we're all knit together, would we rather listen to Britney Spears or Vaclav Havel? Or would we rather, and at any point now, thanks to these wonderful communications, we have the choice in some ways. And as we're thinking about what the global neighborhood means, will we turn to Desmond Tutu or will we turn to the latest pop singer?
Right.
Some of the pop singers are actually doing a great job, like Bono, who features prominently in this book.
Exactly, he does.
But globalism is only as deep as the attention we bring to it. And so it's up to us, I think, to try to give it a real fabric beyond those surfaces that are so exciting for a minute but don't really help us in the fundamental questions of our lives. And I think the reason, it goes back to your earlier question, one reason personally I spent so much time thinking about the Dalai Lama was try to think about how globalism really, in its highest form, is universal. And it's saying not just that we're all eating the same food, watching the same movies, and listening to the same songs, but that we're all worried about the economy, and we're all thinking about our children, and we're all not sure what to do about our aging parents, and those kind of things. And those knit us together, whether we're in China or Tibet or California, in a much deeper and more sustaining way than just the common currency of images that we share. And I think the Dalai Lama is somebody who's always speaking for that position precisely because he's not distracted by surfaces. For example, right. The Potala Palace in Lhasa, where he used to live, is now surrounded by 223 karaoke parlors, 658 brothels, and discos beyond number. And people always ask him, journalists again, ask him, how do you feel about your old capital and your old home being surrounded by this? He says, no problem. That's there. Can't do anything about it. Let's not be distracted from the most important thing, which is just freedom of speech and freedom of thought for Tibetans. We have relatively limited amount of time, and the more time we think about discos, the less time we're thinking about those people who are in prison or who are not allowed to carry a picture of their exile leader. And, he's got a great gift for just cutting through that extraneous stuff and saying, let's go to the core. After I finished the book, I happened to be reading an article a few months ago. It was about Northern Ireland, and it said that they'd found in Northern Ireland that two men with two shovels in a shed could construct a half-ton bomb. And when this fact was presented to a police chief, he said, I think very wisely, well, you can't decommission shovels. You've got to decommission mines. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think that's exactly what the Dalai Lama is doing, which is the only reforms that really last take place at the level of our minds, our decisions, our motivations, our conscience, our imagination. So let's concentrate on that and not worry whether we're wearing a T-shirt or where the T-shirt comes from even.
And I guess that makes it clear in my mind sort of the significance of the Dalai Lama as, you know, someone who can sort of model and sort of enact these behaviors and these values. And I guess at this point I'd like, you know, in the book it comes across so poignantly for the Tibetans themselves who are in Tibet and view their exiled leader a 25-day trip away from where they are, trying very hard to get there to see him. I'd love it if you would read for us. I think, you know, to get a flavor of our writers here and how they put together their prose. Would you care to read that segment? It really showcases not only just a really poignant moment in the lives of Native Tibetans, but also your journalistic skills here. It's really good writing.
Oh, thank you. And I think it's also an attempt to show the kind of thing that takes place behind closed doors that most of us here seeing him when he comes to Los Angeles would never begin to imagine. Mm-hmm. So it's from 20 years ago, and it'll only last 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps the most moving moment I ever witnessed in Dharamsala came in 1988, when I was invited during the Tibetan New Year celebrations centered on the Dalai Lama's temple to stand in on one of the meetings the Dalai Lama holds with Tibetans who've just arrived after treacherous flights across the mountains to see him again. Many of these people had risked their lives traveling 3 weeks across Himalayan passes in midwinter to meet with him for a few minutes and then would cross back over the mountains, perhaps never to see him again. The people who were gathered in the room, maybe 30 or so, were strikingly ragged, their poor clothes rendered even poorer and more threadbare by their long trip across the snowcaps. They assembled in three lines in a small space, and all I could see were filthy coats, blackened faces, sores on hands and feet, straggly, unwashed hair. When the Dalai Lama came into the room, it was as if the whole place began to sob and shake. Instantly, among almost all the people assembled on the floor, there was a wailing, a convulsive movement, a release of all the feelings of hope and fear and concern and relief that had been building for some of them for over 30 years. The man sat before them, seeking them out with shrewd, attentive eyes, and none of the adults before him could even look at him. "Even we cannot watch this often," whispered the Dalai Lama's private secretary, who'd stood by his side imperturbable, as calm as the monk he once was for almost a quarter of a century at that point. The Dalai Lama sat firmly in the middle of the tumult, though later he would tell me that, although generally sadness is manageable, even he was sometimes moved to shed a tear when he saw all the hopes that these people brought to him and all that they had suffered. "Sometimes we try to find someone else to do this for us," the secretary went on where we stood. "It's just too much." The Dalai Lama tends to be more brusque with Tibetans than he is with Westerners, partly because he knows that that's what they expect of him, and partly because he knows that they would be discomforted by too much familiarity from someone they regard as an incarnation of a god. But now he went down the lines, greeting each person in turn, asking, I could guess, where this person came from, how things were in her local area, what might be done to help. Each person, in answer to the questions, looked down or just began to howl and shake with sobs. Only a few children sitting in the front, the smallest in the party, answered the questions, their high piping voices telling him they came from Calm, or their father was a farmer, or their trip had taken them 23 days. Only the children had not been storing up their hopes for all these years with only this one chance to release them. Then, after making sure that all the refugees would be properly looked after and given new homes here if that was what they wanted, the Dalai Lama told them to keep their spirits up and their hearts intent on how they could help others. The 4 hours every morning of meditation were, I saw now, straightforward compared with the house those foundations supported. And I'd just
That's
like
lovely.
To add...
Yeah. Yes.
And I'd just like to add one sentence to that, which is I saw a scene exactly like that 5 months ago when I was traveling with him in Japan. And we went up, when we got to Yokohama, very glossy hotel, we went up to a conference room on the top floor and went into a room, and there were about 60 people there. And again, as soon as he came in, they all began to sob. And they fell on the ground and they did ritual three-part prostrations before him. And although there were chairs laid out for them, all the time he was sitting, offering Buddhist counsel and directing them to certain Buddhist texts, they sat on the floor. And as soon as he finished talking, they all clustered around him and just wanting a blessing or a touch. And every one of those people was Han Chinese from the People's Republic of China. And I think that's, again, one of the promising things, developments, slow but inevitable, that we don't hear much about in the news.
It's the picture of a man with so much compassion and empathy comes across in this book in such a beautiful way. There's a moment where you're in his company and you're having a theological conversation with him that sounds rather intense, and I imagine you're sort of on your tiptoes trying to stay ahead and stay in that engaged in that conversation. When if I read it correctly, he sort of broke from that moment to notice that your teacup was empty.
He's the most alert and attentive person I've ever met. At the last time I saw him, he said, "Oh, I remember the last time I saw your father. It was 23 years ago. He's wearing a yellow shirt." You know, he meets literally probably thousands of people every day, and he remembered the shirt that one person in his life from 23 years ago and the other side of the world wore. Sometimes when he's addressing large audiences, he'll suddenly see somebody maybe in the seventh row and say, "I saw you in Lhasa in 1953. It's phenomenal, and I think in some ways it's not superhuman again or extraterrestrial. It's the fruit of spending 9 hours of meditation every day for 67 years, and that's a way of honing your facilities and your concentration and your ability to see essentials to a remarkable degree. And so again, it's like seeing a very, very high-powered computer at work that instantly will, it would take us 10 minutes to make a calculation, and the computer does it instantly. And that's kind of how he is. And I think also just always thinking, his first thought is the other person. I remember I saw him the day after he won the Nobel Prize. Such is the curiosity of his life. He was in Newport Beach, just down the road here, when the Nobel Prize was announced. And I was in Santa Barbara, and I heard the news on the radio, so I went down to see him to give my congratulations. Mm-hmm. And I felt a little guilty intruding on him when he was so busy, but I felt that he wouldn't mind, and indeed he didn't. As soon as I opened the door, he grabbed me by the hand, and he whisked me off into another room. And I think he would have done this to anyone who'd come calling that day. And as soon as we went into the other room, he spent a few minutes trying to find a chair in which I'd be comfortable. "Oh, would this be okay? Would you rather sit over there?" As if, I was the new Nobel laureate, and he was the intrusive journalist. Yeah. And then he sat down, and again, sit as close as you are to me now, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, I've won all this money. How should I spend it?" And he was listening for an answer. I was barely 30 years old. I didn't know the difference between the Nobel Prize and the National League MVP. But he was asked, and I'm sure he asked everybody that he met that day in the succeeding weeks. And again, with his empirical mind, listened for the best suggestions. And then, interestingly, many years later, I found that when he won substantial amount of money from the Nobel Committee, he didn't really give much of it at all to the Tibetan community, but he gave it to Mother Teresa, to the continent of Africa, and to Costa Rica to set up a university for peace. So again, his thought was, "I'm not a Tibetan. I'm a member of the human family, and this belongs to all of us." And I think made a point of giving it to different traditions, different religions, and different continents, as a way of saying it's all our prize.
And what I find so interesting, too, and as we come close to 8 here, and I want to open this up to questions, too, so you might want to think of some questions to talk to Pico about, is towards the end of the book. With this passage that you read is so evocative. He reminds me of a parent of sorts in which the children are approaching. And like any parent, it strikes me that he is someone who is trying to prepare his children for the world without him. And I guess as I finished this book, I had to ask the question, you know, will there be a 15th Dalai Lama? And will that person matter? I guess that's the end of the question.
You've given such a sensitive and thoughtful reading. If only all readers picked up everything in the book that you did. Thank you so much for that. And I think that question is the same question he's been asking himself probably every hour for 39 years, in fact, because he first gave an answer to that question when he was only 34 years old, just in case he were to die very, very young. And at that point, he said that if there's a 15th Dalai Lama, by definition, he will be somebody who's completely loyal to and advances the program of the 14th Dalai Lama. And what he was doing by that, of course, was preempting the very distinct chance that as soon as he's dead, the Chinese leadership in Beijing will alight upon an amenable 2-year-old boy, probably the son of communist cadres, and say, this is the new 15th Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama has already preempted that by saying that a little boy like that who isn't advancing along exactly the same path and championing the rights of the Tibetans will not be the Dalai Lama of Tibetan hearts. But I think, you know, as a radical as well as a realist, he knows that new circumstances require very new solutions. So he's often stressed that if there's a 15th Dalai Lama, he will almost certainly be born in exile. He may be a she, it could be a woman, or it could be nobody at all. Traditionally, when a Dalai Lama dies, a search party of monks scatters across Tibet, finds a 2-year-old boy, and then the whole of Tibet has to wait for about 15 or 20 years until that boy comes to maturity. And Tibet doesn't have the luxury of being able to wait in that same way now. So my personal suspicion, though he's never said this to me or I think to anyone, is that he will designate somebody in the exile community and say to his fellow Tibetans, this person speaks with my voice for our common purpose. Please listen to him as if it were me, or please listen to her as if she were me. He's set up in exile a democratically elected government and prime minister and cabinet. But the fact of the matter is that because the Dalai Lama is regarded as a god for Tibetans, no Tibetan will listen to the prime minister when there's a god around. Right. So when I asked him what will happen, when I asked him most recently, he mentioned, well, we've got a prime minister and we've got a new generation of monks and all of that. But I think even he knows that none of them carry the weight and stature and the unequivocal authority of a Dalai Lama. So I think he will, in some senses, either appoint one. He said that maybe Tibetans will even choose their next Dalai Lama. But I think it would make more sense if I were him. Luckily, I'm not. Luckily right. for all of us, to appoint one.
My final question has to do with the ending of the book again, and a look at the future. There's a wonderful moment where you know, we all look at the future and we try to project into it what we can. We want to know how things are going to resolve. And we think we know, and we sort of tie ourselves up in knots over the process. At a certain point, you know, I'm not sure whether it was in conversation with the Dalai Lama or not, but the question of the future came up, I believe. And he simply turned to you. And I think it's a really interesting note to end a book on or come near the conclusion of this book on. The Dalai Lama turned to you and said, I don't know. The notion of, and you write about it so well, you're almost channeling Buddhism at this point as well, is this sense of I don't know as being sort of a great grace note of not trying to force an answer and trying to let things just sort of play out as they will.
Yes, and I think, again, it goes back to the title, The Open Road. And my sense of Buddhism, like, you know, the Buddha always spoke of a path. And there's a sense of walking along a road, going around turns, meeting unexpected obstacles, meeting unexpected opportunities. But as you're going along it, you really don't know what's going to happen the next moment or what's going to happen around the next curve. And you have to remain absolutely prepared and ready for any eventuality, as the Dalai Lama always stresses. But it's folly to kid yourself into the notion that you know what's going to happen right. next week. And even this man who's a very clear-sighted leader doesn't. But one of the things that he always stresses is that until the last moment, anything is possible. And you mentioned earlier, one of the beauties of his life is that two of his closest friends, or three of his closest friends, are all Christians, Desmond Tutu, Jimmy Carter, and Vaclav Havel. But certainly, I'd say two of his most close champions and associates and colleagues for 15 years or more have been Desmond Tutu and Vaclav Havel. And he saw Vaclav Havel one day wake up in prison, and 8 weeks later, unanimously selected as president of Czechoslovakia. He saw Desmond Tutu wake up one day under the shadow of apartheid, never having been able to vote for 62 years, and the next day wake up in South Africa without apartheid. A South Africa in some ways more troubled and dangerous than ever before, but at least Desmond Tutu and all the people of his race had a freedom. And so he's seen these unimaginable changes. He was in Berlin as the wall was coming down. And I think as a leader for 67 years, having seen his people and the world through World War II and the Cold War and the Internet Revolution and so many other things, he realizes that so often things will happen in July that none of us foresaw in January, as was the case with the end of the Cold War. And so that's, I think, one reason why he says never give up to Tibetans in your discussion with China. Next month, a new Chinese leader could come up who is interested in Buddhism or is sympathetic to Tibet in a way that hasn't happened before. Next month, a new American president, or next season, a new American president could come to power who knows how best to work with China and draw their attention to Tibet. So just work your hardest because you don't know what's coming next. And I was so touched that, again, it goes back to the computer memory. He said to me, in answer to many questions, "I don't know." And then suddenly he remembered that 23 years earlier, his first trip to Europe in 1973, an old Englishman had come up to him and said, "You know, we never have leaders who say, 'I don't know.'" And the Dalai Lama was quite surprised by that. Right. So surprised that he thought about it for 23 years. And then he met me and he said, "Well, you're from England. Can you cast any light on this statement from 23 years ago? Is it indeed rare for somebody to say, 'I don't know'?" And of course, I was clueless as always. But I was touched that he was still thinking about, you know, if you were to ask him some of these questions right now and then were to visit him in Dharamsala 5 years later, he would remember them and say, "Well, Tom, I've been thinking about this. And, you know, I've got a better answer. I've got a more refined answer than the last time you asked." Which makes him such a touchingly human.
And I think that's where, at a certain point in the book, you write as sort of a synonym for the open road, a state of perpetual becoming.
Yes.
And I think that's a nice way to think of it. Yeah. At this point, Justin has a microphone, and so these conversations are only so good as we can bring you into play as well. So if you have a question for Pico, please make your I see a hand right back there.
I don't know when the last time was that you were able to speak to the Dalai Lama, but in the face of the recent events that have taken place and the unrest that's taken place in Tibet, I understand there are negotiations going on between the Dalai Lama and some Chinese authorities who appear to be quite cynical about the sincerity of his statement that he's not seeking independence. Just curious, has he ever given you any indication of how he would specifically speak to the Chinese authorities who doubt his sincerity, call him divisive, call him, well, jackal and everything else?
He's often kind of thrown up his hands, and I think all of us know this situation from our own lives, that if you go up to somebody who just doesn't trust anything you say, how do you break that gridlock? You can be as honest and sincere and consistent as possible, but if they're habituated to distrust, you're in a very, very difficult situation. As you say, he for 23 years now, or 21 years rather, he's never asked for independence. He's never called for a free Tibet. He's only asked for autonomy, what he says is a safe Tibet. That, as he said, is a maximum concession in some ways. He's given China much more than most Tibetans would like him to have given, and still they haven't budged a bit. He sends his trusted delegates to these meetings, and this is the seventh round of talks since 2002, and they just go up and down. I think a couple of years ago, the Chinese showed much more openness, and they said, "Well, actually, we want to discuss the Tibetan future." But then 6 months later, the next round of talks came, and they changed utterly. So I think he realizes that there's nothing he can do except keep to his path, remain absolutely consistent, keep his motivations pure, and just wait for, as Tom was saying so wonderfully, developments or new developments to unfold. And it's striking that President Clinton, President Bush, Prime Minister Blair, so many of the most influential world leaders have said to the Chinese, what's so scary about just talking to a monk? Nothing bad can happen from sitting across a table from him for an hour, and something good may come, and you may be disarmed by him. As long as he's far away, you can think of him as a jackal or an evil spirit or a wolf in monk's robes. But if you meet him, you'll find he's not such a threatening or formidable figure. And so far they haven't listened to that, but who knows?
It's a good question.
And he always stresses, I guess the other thing he always stresses is he doesn't care what happens to him. People often ask him, when will you go to Tibet? What would be the conditions for your returning to Tibet? He said, that's irrelevant. Doesn't matter about me. The only concern is the 6 million Tibetans. So if he were in the same room with the Chinese leadership, I don't think he would really be talking at all about his geographic location or even his position in a future Tibet. He'd just be talking first and foremost about their freedoms of speech and thought.
Good. Questions? A gentleman back behind you there, Justin.
With all the calculations and the thought and the meditation for all these years, regardless of what any solutions to problems are, has he expressed what the root cause of suffering is?
Ignorance. But I think that's not his expression, that's the Buddha's. And one thing I realized from, I spent 5 years intensively going over and over his words and his thinking much more deeply about everything he said than I had before, and realized how much everything he says comes from the Buddha. When he has an hour free in an airport and his plane is delayed, what he does is pick up the Buddha's teachings and read them, and then read the commentaries of a Tibetan scholar and the commentaries of an Indian scholar. That's his love and passion in life. The way some of us may watch the Lakers or listen to U2 or whatever, his love is the Buddha's teaching. And I think that's why I think everything. And what part of the interest of for me of watching the Dalai Lama is somebody who's working with this teaching that, from his point of view, doesn't need to be changed or hasn't changed for 2,500 years, but bringing it to an accelerating, instantly changing world in which most of us live in circumstances that the Buddha could never have imagined. And so it's that dance between changelessness and change. Just as I was finishing this book, I found an account that my father had written in 1960 after his talk with the Dalai Lama, which I'd never seen before, when, as I said, the Dalai Lama was 24 years old. And what struck me so forcibly was that in 1960, in his first year in exile, the Dalai Lama was saying word for word the same things that he would be saying when he comes to Los Angeles 6 months from now. But even though his positions have remained changeless, his application of them is constantly evolving. He follows the news much more closely than any journalist I know. And so each time he comes to Los Angeles, he has a better sense of what the needs of the community are, what the questions of the community are, what the constituency of an audience is, and he will take those changeless principles and come up with some new formulation that he thinks may be most useful to this particular audience. I remember some years ago he said to me that he was addicted to something, and I thought, what could the Dalai Lama be addicted to except non-attachment or impermanence or something like that, compassion. And he said, no, he was addicted to the BBC World Service. He listens to it every morning in Dharamsala while he's meditating at 5:30 in the morning. And he said, in that way of his, that's very direct. There's no fake modesty or no games going on. He said, really, that when he traveled, and if he couldn't listen to the BBC World Service, he really felt that something fundamental was missing from his life. But in terms of the cause of suffering, I think the Buddhists would say that it's ignorance. And the beauty of that is ignorance is remediable by any person at any time, and it doesn't come with the judgments that good and evil. Instead of talking of good and evil, they talk of awakening and ignorance. And part of the beauty of that is saying that all of us are partially awakened and partially ignorant. Part of the beauty is saying any one of us could wake up, if so we choose to apply ourselves, and that when we see somebody, like a child who's ignorant, we think of them very differently than when we see somebody who's evil. We're much more forgiving, and we think, we're really in the same boat as them in some ways. And so I think it's a lovely way of freeing us from certain of the you're with us or against us kind of ways of thinking.
Since Pico opened the door, he mentions you too. When I read books, I often, the first thing I'll look at in sort of a bored moment, we'll read the acknowledgments and we'll read the suggested readings. He has a marvelous bibliography at the back of this book. But you too gets cited in both the readings as well as in the acknowledgments. I think he wrote this book as simply an opportunity to travel the world and listen to Bono sing, as well as, I'm not sure who's your greater fan, the Dalai Lama or Bono, or everywhere.
That's true. I did fly all over the world listening to U2's Vertigo. I went saw them here in L.A., in Denmark, in Tokyo, in New Jersey, all over.
On the course of hard work, of course.
Exactly, research. You know, it's hard studying Tibetan Buddhism at its source. But one reason that I invoke U2 quite a bit, and I know certain more hardened readers, that's a jarring note, but it's a just way, like, you know, the title, The Open Road, comes from D.H. Lawrence writing about Walt Whitman. And for me, it was very important to say that what I learn, because I'm not a Buddhist and I'm not a Tibetan, from the Dalai Lama, is something I could also learn from Walt Whitman or D.H. Lawrence or so many great writers within our own tradition. It's not faraway exotic knowledge, but it's actually part of our own culture. Emerson and Thoreau, I think, word for word, Thoreau was the person who oversaw the first translation of a Buddhist text into English. And so if you read them, you're essentially reading a lot of what the Dalai Lama brings to non-Buddhist audiences. So one reason that I stressed U2 was, apart from the intrinsic value of U2, saying, well, you can get
rock and roll.
Yeah, that's right, and get interesting ideas about a global conscience, about our responsibility towards the poor, about the notion that a grandmother in Africa or a kid in the slums in Dhaka is these days really in our neighborhood as much as the person in Compton or the grandmother in Pacific Palisades, that location is less and less important. And in fact, in that world, we help ourselves by helping the person in Dhaka or Africa as we help ourselves by cleaning up some of the poorer parts of Los Angeles. And, you know, I think Bono has spoken about that as eloquently as anyone else. And so, again, I'm trying to say that the Dalai Lama is just one voice among many who's offering these general global, and in this case, secular ideas that are offering us new global opportunities. But you don't have to listen to the Dalai Lama or to Bono, but it's in the air. You know, something that moves me is that Bill Gates, who spent so much time accumulating money, is now using that same ingenuity and resourcefulness and finding ways of giving it away. There's certainly a movement swelling among all our politicians and many of our prominent people in that global direction, and the Dalai Lama is just one in a chorus of others.
Yeah, there's a wonderful part in the book where he parses the lyrics of One Love, and it's really quite nicely done. All right, other questions? Okay, two more questions. So I pointed to you, so there you are.
Could you talk a little bit about his relationship with science and how each has influenced the other?
Yes. I think many people who know more about it than I say that for all those years when Tibet was in seclusion, when it was the most sequestered country in the world, its philosophers were using that remoteness, like monks on retreat, to engage in very, very deep study of the human mind and all the intricacies and illusions and fogs and sunshine and possibilities that exist in this human mind. At the same time as explorers in the West were mapping Afghanistan and Africa, and scientists across the West were learning a lot about the material world. So at a very simple level, he says that now that Tibet can learn from and give to the world, and now that we're all part of one body and have access to one another's wisdom, Tibet can perhaps teach us something about the properties of the mind and emotions, and Tibet has a lot to learn from us about the latest technologies, about innovations, about the material world that people in Caltech and MIT and many, many other great universities have done so intensively and so authoritatively for so long. As you know, when he was a little boy, his inclination was towards science, and I think that goes with his realism. His sense that, you know, I've noticed he doesn't watch movies very much, he doesn't read novels, he's not interested in what ifs, as a leader from the age of four, he's never been in a position where he can think about romantic or abstract ideas. He's dealing with the here and now, and I think he likes that the empirical process of science as well as just the facts of science. So as you probably know, for more than 20 years he conducts a yearly mind and life meeting, especially with neuroscientists and scientists of consciousness, where he and other Tibetan monks bring the ideas of their studies of the mind together with what scientists, especially at Wisconsin, Princeton, Harvard, and Berkeley, are doing now that they can take, you know, whole x-rays of the mind and brain scans. And one of the happy developments is that for many years the early explorers to Tibet, like Alexander David Neal and some of the ones in the 19th century, came back from Tibet with all these seemingly magical stories about what monks can do in terms of changing the temperature in their bodies and drying wet sheets just through the force of their meditation. And now scientists in our best universities are actually subjecting Tibetan monks to those tests and finding that that's all true. And finding quantifiable, verifiable scientific evidence for what you can do with your mind. And that you, certain of these monks, Matthieu Ricard is a great example, who's a French scientist who's also a Tibetan Buddhist monk. And he travels around and shows you these charts that the best scientists have created, where they conduct experiments on lay people and meditators to test happiness and self-possession and serenity and those kind of things. And in certain capacities, the monks are literally, their figures are off the charts. When UOI is asked to concentrate on compassion, and a Buddhist or other monk is asked to concentrate on compassion, scientists have shown that they can activate the neural zone associated with compassion 700 times more than lay people can. So I think he's excited, because he doesn't like theories, he likes hard facts. He's excited that now these researchers are actually giving numbers and empirical proofs to what previously were just suppositions.
That's great. Okay, one more question. How about that gentleman right there? Oh, I'm sorry. You'll be able to talk to Pico out in the lobby. So,
with the Dalai Lama's schedule, how does he manage to do 9 hours of meditation a day?
It's amazing. And in the book, I ask him about that. And I visited him after not having seen him for a few years. And I said, how have things changed? And he said, oh, nothing really much changes. You know, there's this change in the Indian political system since the last time you were here. I've had a bit of a cough. And he said, as for my spiritual practice, I don't do very much of that. And I said, oh, really? And he said, yeah. And then he took me through his day. And he said, well, I wake up at 3:30. And then I do 4 hours of meditation and prostrations. And then I do another hour meditation and prostrations. And then I go and read some Tibetan philosophy. And then I take care of the business of my government. And then I come back to my room at 5:30 and I do some more meditation. And then I do more prostrations. And I counted it all up and it was 9 hours. But I think one fruit of that meditation is extraordinary amount of energy. And many of us know that, I think a mother typically knows that if she's looking after her kids, she has much more energy than when she's just concentrating on, let's say, writing her book or doing something for herself, that selflessness often releases energies we didn't know we had. And so to this day, he's 72 years old, and it's the case that I get absolutely exhausted just watching him go through this day. And I'll just end by saying, you know, the last time I saw him in Japan, one day I remember we were in the little town of Ise, and I met him at 7:30, so he'd already done 4 hours of meditation. I was groggy from just having had my breakfast, but he's already deep into his day. He began his day by meeting representatives from all the Buddhist sects in Zen and Shugendo and Shugen and other and Shinto priests too, all the religious groups in Japan. Then he did an interview with a young woman who runs a small magazine on the environment, and he loves talking to young people because he figures that's the future, and he's concerned about the environment, so he did an interview with her. We went into a train. Two journalists came in and did a conversation with him and interviews about his political life. We got off the train. Five Tibetan students were waiting for him there. So he had a very serious conversation with them about Tibet and the future of Tibet. We got into another train. There were more people with more questions of him. We got out, went to lunch, and he had a lunch with a Japanese politician. And then he went upstairs, and then his official day began. And a group of scientists came and showed him some research they'd done on compassion. And then a group of organizers of a Buddhist conference and he was going to speak before 5,000 people the following day. They came and sort of made a ceremonial visit. And then an emissary from Japanese High Society came and gave him a book from the Empress. Then he did a TV interview. Then he went into this room, as I was describing, and saw 60 Chinese people. Then he went back and did another interview. Then he went into another room and met another group of Chinese who were working for democracy on the mainland. Then he went back and did two more interviews. And then it was 5:30, and I left him, and his day began, and he went back to meditation and prostration. And, you know, I was keeling over just 10 hours of saying nothing and watching him. But he continues that schedule, I would say, every day of his life since he became temporal leader of Tibet when he was 15 years old. So that's 58 years now. And I think his doctors worry about him, but the one people he doesn't listen to is his doctors. And he says, you know, this is my chance to do some good. I'm going to do it.
Wonderful. Well, Pico, thank you very much. This is wonderful.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.